The Breakfast Club.
Adam White's with us on a Thursday morning. Good morning, Whitey.
When are we going to have our forum?
Well, we just like to tease. It's Radio Craft tease. We've been teasing for 5 years.
Yes.
It's going to be a forum. Not quite sure which one to focus on just at the moment.
Got a few ideas. We've dropped to fifth on the medal table.
What?
Great Britain have gone ahead of us because of the amount of silver medals.
Because they're vaccinated.
They've had.
Sure, that's why.
So silver medal
favoritism
factor sees Australia drop to fifth, but there's gold medals up for grabs today, and particularly the hockey tonight, and a couple of other bits and pieces.
Yes.
So we'll see how we go.
Yes, the Cookers. That's a very important one tonight against the Belgians. That's going to be good business. I'll be watching that.
So I've got a question for you off the top, and it's not just for you, but it's for everybody out there, 1-300-652-927 or 0416-90-50-52. Last night, I stayed up to watch Peter Bowl.
Yes, good.
Now, it wasn't that late, but for us, it's probably late.
It's pushing the boundaries.
Get up so early. It's asking questions of yourself.
Yeah, it's pushing the boundaries.
All I could think of was staying up late to watch Black Caviar run at Ascot.
Oh.
Because it was a similar sort of situation. It was a race.
She was a bit later, wasn't she?
No, she was. She was about 10 past 12, maybe. Maybe 20 to 1.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. But you knew, staying up to watch the race, there was many other Australians that were in that category, that they were staying up to watch that race.
Yes.
Staying up to watch an event.
I was there. Well, I wasn't there. I was watching on the couch.
So what is the event that you remember the most? What is the event that you remember the most staying up for late to watch? So not getting up early to watch, which would be, say, a Masters or something happening in America or a European Cup final or something like that. But what would be the thing that you remember the most of actually staying up for and really being excited about, you know, you're sort of having another cup of tea or another block of chocolate or whatever it is you're doing to stay up to watch something that you wouldn't necessarily otherwise watch?
Oh, but, well, that changes the
parameters. Well, it does a little bit. It probably just changes the rules there on the run. But I was thinking it last night that I was genuinely excited about watching Peter Bowl run last night, having never really had any interest in what Peter Bowl's done in the past.
Well,
we've had him in the studio and so forth.
We're going to play a bit of that shortly too, just by the way.
But you know what I mean? Like, it was just one of those things that you wanted to watch just to see how he went, because he did so well in the semi-finals, probably exceeded expectations, and as an Australian, you want to see how he went. What other events do you remember doing that for?
The things that stand out for me now, I probably would have watched them anyway. So it's not as if I went to the, I'll just hang around and see what happens sort of thing. But the Pat Cash Wimbledon victory.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I was under the pool table in Germana, watching that as a young fella. I do remember that one vividly. That's the first thing that came to mind.
That's absolutely in my list of three.
What year was that? 87?
1987. Beat Ivan Lendl in straight sets.
I don't remember that part of it, but I remember he won. And he jumped into the stands. That was exciting as a 10-year-old. So that was... And then the semi-final of the World Cup in England when we defeated South Africa. I remember staying up specifically for that one, because I didn't see that whole campaign. And then the drama that ensued, which was quite dramatic. And I woke the house up that night. My father was not happy that next morning. They're the two. Pat Cash is the standout for me. That's what we all waited up for. I was sleeping under the pool table watching Pat Cash.
Yep, I reckon that would absolutely be my top three.
At a friend's holiday house.
Yep.
Yep. What do you got for us?
No, I think...
What's in the other, on the podium?
For me, Pat Cash was number one. But Caviar would be number two, staying up to watch that. Now, again, you would do that probably anyway, but there was that excitement around what time's the race.
Yeah.
You know, wonder how she'll go, all that sort of thing. Whereas something like the World Cup qualifier where John Aloisi scored, I mean, that's just a normal sort of Saturday night type situation. You're not having to stay up later than a normal time. So the other one that sort of stood out to me a little bit was kind of by accident. So again, it's probably not the same category, was the sandpaper gate. When you're sitting there at sort of 1 o'clock in the morning watching it all unfold, going, is anyone else watching this at this moment in time?
Oh, yes.
Did I just see what I saw? But that was a bit different. But again, it's watching something that's late. But I reckon Pat Cash and Black Caviar...
You didn't make everyone stay up for that just for that reason.
No. Black Caviar and Pat Cash would be the two where it was that whole thing of stay awake, you know, wonder how you'll go, wonder how she'll go. And I think there was a little bit like that with Peter Bowl last night. It was just a, you know, it was 2 minutes of sport after 10 o'clock where you're sort of waiting, just waiting and waiting, checking the time, getting ready for the race. And I wasn't quite as excited as Bruce McAvaney was, but it was still, yeah, it was an event.
Was that 99, that World Cup?
It was.
Because someone said that off the SMS, that they've gone the final. I went the semi, they went the final. Because we smacked Pakistan in the final, didn't we?
Yeah, really easily. Bowled them out for 130 or something.
I think I watched it, but I was more excited about the semi against South Africa.
Which we didn't win. It was a tie.
Someone says that as well. World Cup semi against South Africa. That's good. Socceroos in Germany. Never a big soccer fan.
Yeah, that's a good one.
But caught up in the wave, says the Baker. Morning Baker. That's a good one. Pat Cash in Wimbledon, says Jezza. Rafter versus Ivanisevic.
Yes.
Wimbledon final. Yeah, that I certainly made an effort to watch that. Well, didn't quite stack up to the Cash and Lindell 10-year-old situation, because different generation, I suppose.
Well, showing off there, I was actually in the UK at the time. That was 2001.
So you were working on local time?
I was. It was after the... And it was either after or the last day of the Edgbaston Test. Australia versus England. It was held on a Monday because of the amount of rain.
Well, no. Take your word for that.
Yeah.
I watched it. What else we got? So what about 9/11? That was literally unbelievable. Yeah, but yeah. That's true, but you didn't wait up for expecting that to happen.
That's not a sporting event.
It's a slightly different category, but because Nick Holland was on Talking Footy that night. I remember that. On the old Talking Footy, when the first tower was flown into.
Right.
I thought, what's going on here? And so I changed the channel. Sorry, Dutchie. I changed the channel. See, your one about Black Caviar is interesting. So I will go back even further. Oh, and this was a long time ago, clearly. I can't even remember the year. But when Schwarzier went across and became the sort of the poster boy, that was something that I made an effort to stay up and absolutely
be
a part
of. 100% the same.
Both those races, the King Stand because, and the Golden Jubilee.
Yeah, because there was that period of about 4 or 5 years where I think a lot more people than now would be interested in how the Australian horses would go at Ascot. I've got to be a bit careful with what I say here, but I think that that's right. I think there was that period of time.
Why do you have to be careful?
Well, because maybe people just stay up every year. But I think there was a period of time where Royal Ascot, because the Australians, first time they kind of went over there, and clearly doing really well with Takeover Target and Scenic Blast and all these sorts of things. But there was that period where you would stay up and watch it, and the BBC coverage was awesome, and yet I'd find myself watching it till all hours, you know, every night of the carnival. But that was, we're going back sort of 15 years ago now for that, I reckon.
We'll check that. I'll check what year that was. Liverpool FA Cup when Craig Johnson scored, said the Prezi stayed up for that. That's a good one.
Well, that's another one of...
That's a good one.
As a youngster staying up to watch the FA Cup final.
Yes, I do remember. I didn't stay up and watch that because it wasn't really my bag. Because that would have been, what year was that? Craig Johnson, Liverpool FA Cup final. I'm going to Google that. I want to find out what that is. But that's the sort of thing that, these are the ones, the first sort of stuff. Like Cash at Wimbledon, Johnston at Liverpool, for me it was Schwarzier at Royal Ascot. The ones that come first, where Australians or Australia is performing on an international stage that sort of is that breakthrough moment or that groundbreaking moment, they're the ones that sort of stand out for me, I must admit.
Schwarzer was 2003. That's 18
years ago.
Jeez.
2008.
Terrifying.
And that's, what's that, June? June-ish. Is that what, Ascot's June-ish?
Yep.
2003, I was really weighing up my career then. Maybe that's why I was awake. Just pondering.
Staring at the roof. What might have been.
1974 Cricket World Cup. Off the SMS. Viv Richards ran out half our team.
That's right. That happened.
Is that right?
Yeah, that absolutely happened.
That was even... You would have been good to stay up that night.
Well, I wasn't alive.
That's right. That's what I'm saying.
But there's that... Because there's... I mean, obviously there's the Ashes and things like that where, well, again, if you're a cricket fan, you just start and watch it. I mean, obviously there was Test cricket last night. But it's more that event, that one thing that, again, you wouldn't necessarily stay up for, or the fact that it would start late, so you had to actually make that conscious effort to either stay awake or maybe have a couple of hours sleep and get up and watch it.
Yep.
Different to, as I said, you get up, like even the America's Cup in 1983, that happened very early in the morning as opposed to sort of, you know, staying up late and watching it just after midnight.
Yeah, that was a wake up in the morning and find out what happened sort of situation when I was six.
Yeah.
When you were five, six.
I remember my parents waking me up to watch the final bit of that.
Did they?
And I wasn't old enough to go, "You actually serious? You waking me up to watch a boat race?"
All I remember about that day is Miss Valmorbida, my grade one teacher, came with golden, green and gold streamers in her hair to school. That's all I remember.
I think that's happening at our primary school tomorrow. Everyone's getting dressed up in green and gold.
But it was a momentous occasion, because if she was wearing streamers in her hair, it was a big deal.
Yeah.
She never did that. She made me measure... what she did, while I'm talking about Miss Valmorbida, good morning if you're listening. Got a new name these days, I imagine. Married name. We measured the gap, the width of our mouth. We opened our mouth. And she thought I had a big mouth. So she, like, I talked a lot, which is probably...
It's a surprise.
She probably picked it early. The futures market she got on early, she made a fortune. So we measured the whole class. Open your mouth, see how wide your mouth can stretch. Unsurprisingly, I won. I had the largest gap.
Right.
Hmm. It was an unusual activity.
Yeah, very much so.
I'm still trying to
work about Luna Park or something. Or
yeah, why? No, I don't know why. But it was the day after the America's Cup. It was a big couple of days of my life back in 1983. America's Cup and then the mouth measuring.
Another text here, staying up as an 11-year-old to watch Borg and McEnroe in a Wimbledon final. The days.
I didn't watch any of those finals back then.
I mean, even through the 80s and 90s, it was John Newcomb, Tony Trabert doing the tennis final, Fred Stolle. That were the days when it used to be on Channel 9.
I can't even make midnight on New Year's Eve anymore.
No, neither
SMS.
Can I.
Well, even further to that, because I'm in the same boat, even further to that, I've got no interest in making midnight on New Year's. That's where it's come to these days. This is a good one. The announcement of the Sydney Olympics.
Yes.
We're waiting up for that. Now, I don't think I did, I must admit, but I can imagine why that would have been a key moment for a lot of sports fans.
Who is the New South Wales Premier that just...
Mike Rand.
No.
I don't know any names, by the way.
Enthusiastically jump for joy.
I have no idea. You know my politics stuff, yeah, I've got no idea.
John Fay was the New South Wales Premier of the time. And that was a real sort of involuntary sort of really robust celebration, whereas Anastasia Palaszczuk, when she did it the other day, it didn't seem to have that same sort of spontaneity because she was the $1 chance going in. In fact, there was probably
an N/A
type setup for her.
Money back. Mm. Who is Mike Rand anyway? Is that a person?
No, Mike Rand. Like... Oh. Neville Rand. Right. Mike Rann, I reckon, was Premier of South Australia. Neville Rann is the one you're talking about from New South Wales.
No, I don't know any of these people.
Neville Rann's had a few issues. Well, had a few issues there for a while. A renegade sort of daughter.
I'll take your word for that.
We'll move on.
I'll take your word for that. I don't know too much about that story. Speaking of daughters, did you see the skateboarding yesterday? At the Olympics?
I did. I saw bits and pieces.
What's your take on the skateboarding? I'd love to get your take and our listeners' take. 0416 90 50 52. What's your take on the skateboarding at the Olympics?
Joe, it's RANN, former Premier of South Australia. I'm the wrong person to ask.
No, I'm not. No, you're not. You're the right person.
Well, I don't think it should be in the Olympics.
Yes.
And watching it yesterday, it's almost like it should be. There should be a little bit like a Junior MasterChef. There needed to be a Junior Olympics.
Now, there's my point. This is where I was hoping to get to. I thought that might be your take on it. I found myself feeling like you yesterday watching it. I'm thinking, I don't know if I'm comfortable with this.
So you reckon her bronze medal is as good as Peter Boll running fourth? Now, that's probably a bit unfair in a way, but
no.
It's just not Olympics for me. I'm sorry. It was a great story.
Well, I think when you've got... And I know gymnastics has very young athletes and has done for generations, But when you've got 12-year-olds and 13-year-olds on the podium, I don't know.
No.
I felt like junior, I was with you. I felt junior master chefy.
Yeah.
Oh, it's this isn't the Olympics. This is junior world games or something. Junior
Big M Little League.
Yeah. There was something about that. And I, taking nothing away from the talent and skill of these young people, because they are very, very young people. Good luck to them. And they're awesome. And I wish I could do half the stuff they could do on those things. Although I break just about every bone in my body trying. It just, I don't know. It just didn't sit well with me. I didn't. And are the boys in the men's edition, are they as young or are they a bit older?
I don't know. I think there are some young ones.
Unusually young field.
Yeah.
For a world's best edition.
But I watched a bit of it thinking, and they were really impressed with the young girl that had that serious crash as like a young girl and cracked her skull and whatever else, and she came back. She's only 13 years of age. And the commentary was almost, not condescending, but really sort of, oh, she's doing really well. And I'm sitting there thinking, is she doing well because she's 13? Is she doing well because of what she's come back from? Or is she doing well because she's the best in the world at this? Mm. And I didn't know the answer to it, but I was a bit cynical thinking that that can't be the case. But then I realised later that she first competed in like a world title type thing as an 8-year-old.
See, that sounds unusual.
And I was just, yeah.
That sounds unusual. Of course, the winner was Masugi Okamoto.
And she was 12.
Masugi... wasn't Masugi 19? Wasn't the winner 19?
And one of them was 12, one of them was 13, and the other one was 19. That were the top three.
Sky Brown. Yeah,
Sky Brown was the one.
Sky Brown was
13.
Was the 13-year-old British girl.
Yeah.
Sky Brown had a terrifying crash at Tony Hawk's Linda Vista skate park in San Diego. She fractured her skull, lacerated the lung, and broke her wrist and arm. Poland's Amelia Brodka was among the first to rush to her side. She thought the 12-year-old was dead, which is a great comeback from death to win a medal.
Absolutely.
And she's very, very charismatic, and the kids are great. They're great kids. But I don't know. I just don't know. Just don't know if I'm comfortable with the whole thing. Surely you can't be the world's best at 12 and 13.
Well, I don't know. But they said the podium, they were very young.
well,
but I was watching it the other day, and Sherelle was talking about this. They were falling off. They were laughing. They had iPods in, and they're in an Olympic Games event. It just didn't seem right.
Interesting. Bill's in Werribee. Hello, Bill.
Morning, boys.
What's your take on all this?
This time last week, I sent out to about 25 people in our WhatsApp groups, varying levels of sporting interest, but most of them are pretty much into sport, and asked them to name one athlete competing in the 100-metre sprint at the Olympics. And out of the 25, I had one person came up with Joanne Blake, and the other 24 said I couldn't name one. This would have to be the first time in Olympic history that we don't really know, or that the big names aren't promoted. There just isn't anyone, especially in those big events, that anyone even knew of.
Is that because Usain Bolt dominated and sort of overshadowed everybody?
Yeah, maybe. But I remember as a kid, I knew every Australian going to the Olympics in 84 and Darren Clark in the 400 and all that type of stuff. I hadn't heard of Peter Boland until 3 days ago.
Yeah, I think, Bill, it's interesting. I think it's one of the reasons why the Olympics has kind of struggled in the build-up, is what you're just talking about. And because of the internationalisation of sports, in that they're so much easier to consume, that it makes it harder for those sorts of athletes, I think, to be the stars they once were. Because I 100% agree with you. Now, I think really the 100 metres was 6-1 the field, really. I mean, no one... There was no real stars there. Degrassi was the one that had sort of been in Bolt's shadow 5 years ago, Degrassi, and he ended up winning the 200 metres last night. But you're right, he's not a household name, like, say, a Donovan Bailey and a Linford Christie and Carl Lewis and those sorts of athletes through the 90s. I don't know. I don't disagree with you, Bill.
Yeah, well, I think had you asked me, I would have given you Degrassi and Blake. And that's two.
Yeah.
That's it. Of the field. Now, I had no idea the gold medalist, our man, Marcel. But once you... I think that's part of... my personal opinion is that's part of the fun of the Olympics.
Yeah, they announce themselves on that stage because it is only every 4 years.
And you follow them. Once you sort of pick up on like heats and final semis and stuff, you sort of follow them. You're like, okay, you ran well last time. I like the way you did it.
Yeah.
Or she, or whatever it might be. I think that's part of the attraction of the Olympics, to find these names that you're going to follow. Now you do know, and you're going to follow.
And it is that serious 5 minutes of fame, like, what's her name? Was it Meriwether, the archer?
Simon Fairweather. Fairweather
or
Meriwether?
Andrew Meriwether played for Fitzroy back in the early 80s. I think he did.
Was he any good at archery?
Sure, he could hit targets. but those sorts of athletes, like Lauren Burns, no one knew who Lauren Burns was,
correct.
And all of a sudden she's winning a gold medal.
On the speaking circuit.
That's what the Russell Mark. What the Olympics kind of does, that they burst on, they have their 5 minutes of fame and everyone wants to know their story, and then we'll see you again in another 4 years sort of thing.
Yeah, thank you, Bill. And I think that applies to some events, but we knew all a lot of the swimmers.
Yeah.
And we knew, obviously, the teams that were going over. But athletics in Australia has had a lull. And so if we're not strong here, we probably don't follow it from a global stage. If you consumed elsewhere, this is what we've been saying all the way through. We're so consumed elsewhere with other sport and other things in life.
Yeah.
That we prioritise what we follow and love and get our interest into.
Well, we talked about this yesterday, about the escapism that the Olympics has given all of us from what's going on in the world. Like, they've had some COVID problems in Tokyo as a result of the Olympics going on, but we haven't really heard about that. It's just been about, you know, what's the action, what's going on the track or in the pool, and we've all felt good about life over the last couple of weeks, which has been that escapism.
Mm. What about this? Andrew Meriwether, your man, who you just mentioned, now goes by his birth name, Andrew Guthrie, and he is the father of Cameron and Zechariah to play for the Cats. Your man, random man from 1982 who played one game for Fitzroy, is the father of the Guthrie boys from Geelong. A super sire, if you will.
Well, that's thrown me.
This is one of the great pieces of documentation Frank's ever put on the screen. That is outrageous.
We should get Andrew on.
Well, I want to find out more about
that. Yeah.
Because that's the most random name possibly you've ever brought up. And it turns out that they are having a significant influence on the current modern day world of Australian rules football.
He actually only played one game for Fitzroy, too.
And you remember it. And you were five.
Four.
Well, it depends on what time. We're four.
Well, Fitzroy played finals in the early 80s, maybe. I don't think they did in 82. They did in 81 and 83.
Have you done that?
No, I'm not really too sure.
we're going to find out more about that. By the way, it was Sakura Yasuzumi who won the gold medal in the skateboarding yesterday. She beat, 19-year-old, by the way, Sakura. She beat Kokona. She's 12 years old. And then, of course, Sky, who was the 13-year-old bronze medalist. A very young podium. 31, 34, 44. So, cumulatively, they are 18 years younger than Andrew Hoy. The whole podium age. Mm. That's unusual. Alicia Ferguson, as a part of Matilda's history, 10 years, 11 years wearing national colours and covering the Matilda's campaign in Tokyo at the moment. Big game against the US coming up for bronze tonight. She's been good enough to join us on The Breakfast Club. Alicia, welcome.
I mean, what an introduction. Thanks for that. That may be one of the best introductions I've ever had. I'll take that.
Well, we're happy to have you on board. We love your work. You've got a great resume. And we'll...
history. Love it. I'll take it.
You are a part of sporting history. Absolutely you are.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, can't wait to watch the girls actually in action. I mean, shame we're not going for the gold or the silver, but you know what? It's still a big game against the US. Absolutely huge.
Well, and I think that's probably the point, isn't it? It's the US who have been the all-conquering team in the last however many years. They've won everything, and now we get a chance to beat them for a medal at the Olympics. Now, we would, as you say, gold or silver would have been a bit better, but if you're going to win a bronze, you might as well beat the US to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, we played out a really solid 0-0 draw against them, and of course the US were pretty cranky about losing Canada because the US have won everything.
Yep.
And definitely have that level of arrogance and ego to them, and rightfully so. But I think we've got the measure of them. They're not playing great. They look out of sorts. There's a lot of rotation in the squad. And I know, look, there's arguments. Okay, it wasn't the most exciting game when we played them earlier on. But you know what? I'm loving this Matildas team and how we're developing the game from game. You know, after probably a bit of a shaky start when Tony Gustafsson came in and we had a couple of big losses, heavy losses. But oh, the girls are standing up and under difficult, difficult conditions as well. Like I keep saying, I don't know how I played international football in that heat and humidity. Honestly, I struggle for an hour on a Monday night in London, let alone like. And we used to travel to China all the time and play in that. So yeah, really difficult conditions. But I just think, you know, this is a huge opportunity to continue making history. And I'm pumped.
So what did you expect? What did you forecast coming in? I mean, you're an analyst these days with Optus Sport over there in the UK. What did you expect from the Matildas coming into this?
Honestly, I had absolutely no idea. And I think that was based on Tony coming in, implementing his new style, his philosophy on the players, you know, those early results in the friendlies that we had, not having any time together, all that kind of thing. It was all lots of the unknown. I think the best thing that happened to the players was their ability to go to Sweden. It was sunny there, which has really helped a lot of the players who are based over here because the poor girls are missing the sun. They had a chance to actually just enjoy hanging out together because, you know what, they've all missed each other. Like, they missed each other. They hadn't played together for, what was it, the best part of a year or over a year. Mm. So I think it was just good for them all to reconnect, and I think you can see that on the pitch now, and you can see it with all their social media posts and stuff like that. Like, they're just a really solid unit, and when you're in an elite sporting team, and this is where the US are falling down at the moment, where they have been a solid unit before, they're not now. And I think the Tillies are just, you know, encapsulating everything, every part of that. And it's really, really cool to watch and to see them grow with every game.
Todd Goldstein plays the AFL game, and he does it very, very well. And it's great to have him a part of our team on the Inner Sanctum for 2021. He's back with us. Hello, Todd.
Say, Harv, you didn't really feel me with a lot of confidence with that bet then, did you?
Well, I was a bit confused. The scratchings hurt me. Like, I've just been a bit rattled in the last 2.5 minutes. Just trying to work out.
It did seem that way.
Just, yeah, gamble responsibly, all that sort of stuff, Todd. 7681, if you want to play at Coleraine today. Now, you were playing on the weekend in Tasmania against one of the best teams in football. I'm keen to get your take on what you thought about how your team matched up, because you've come so far, and we've talked about that through the journey in season 2021. But up against the best, you find out heaps more, I reckon. What did you learn from the game on the weekend against the Cats?
Well, I think the overall feeling coming out of the game was that of frustration. It felt like we had a lot of chances. I know, you know, look at the scoring shots and things like that, that it wasn't as close as it may have seemed, but felt like, especially in the first half, our turnovers were just killing us. And, you know, we're now feeling like we walk away from games understanding that we actually have a chance to win them and we're not just hoping to win them. So yep. I think that the feeling of frustration was massive after that game.
That's a good phase to be in, I suppose, that have a chance to win rather than just sort of going to not lose by too much. I mean, it's a different mindset. And I suppose there's an element of not, you know, it's a free swing, I suppose, to a degree, even though I'm not personally into that sort of philosophy. That it's a free swing because you're not expected to win. You've got one of the best teams and you just go out there and do your thing. But you thought on the back of that performance and in review that the way you played and the system you put in place is good enough to match it when you get it right.
Absolutely. And, you know, we felt like we definitely could have attacked the game offensively much better and our skills really let us down at times. But, you know, there are areas that we can tidy up pretty quickly. And I think overall we've been kicking the ball pretty well lately. So hopefully that was just a bit of an aberration, but it gives us great confidence going to the final 3 weeks.
How hard is it to play against Geelong, Todd, with the way that they are defensively? I guess we all get a bit frustrated at times with Geelong that they can be slow in offence considering what they've got in offence, but defensively they're always really hard to play against.
Yeah, it was a really good lesson for the young boys about just what a professional defensive team plays like and how quick they are to react, to getting to the right spot, to really shutting down the space and also then how you attack a team like that. So, you know, it was a great lesson to see how organised they are and something for us to sort of try to reach as we go along with our defensive systems.
So do you, can you lose confidence really quickly, or do you sort of identify the fact that, well, it was Geelong, we've been moving the ball so well over the last sort of 6 to 8 weeks, that's not going to change the way that we play moving forward in the remaining few games?
Oh, from the first few meetings we've had this week, we definitely haven't lost confidence in that game. And I think we got a lot out of it, and that's sort of the attitude we've taken every week this year is, you know, we may not necessarily get the result we wanted, but we're taking a lot of learnings out, and we're training those things, and we're becoming a better team from that. So, you know, I think, if anything, it's going to increase our confidence and understand that we were pretty average with our skills on the day, but we were still only 20 points down, and we were down by only a goal or two for a lot of that game, and had our chances. I mean, Luke Davies-Uniac had a chance to put us within a kick or within a couple of points at one stage in that last quarter. So we did a lot of things right, despite the fact we still couldn't hit a kick.
That makes it hard when you can't hit a kick. It's a challenging game when you can't do that. But that's not a consistent theme with the Kangaroos this year, thankfully. In the build-up to it, Tony, obviously, I feel a bit of drama going on at the Kangaroos last week. I mean, the whole Ben Cunnington situation caught a lot of us off guard and put us on our heels a bit with that situation that he's had to face in the last little bit. What was the mood like at the footy club when you first learned about his problems?
Yeah, I think like everyone else, everyone was very, very shocked. Everyone's thoughts went straight to Ben, to Belinda and the kids, and, you know, hoping that they were all right. And, you know, we did a bit of work. We all sat down as a group and had a chat about it. And, you know, the best thing we could do is go out and focus on doing our jobs and understand that the medical professionals are taking care of Ben and his family are taking care of Ben. So he want to see us play well. And then that was our focus. And, you know, that was, you know, the message that we're sending for the next 3 weeks as well to Ben.
When did you learn about it?
It would have been probably an hour or two before it was released. We got the heads up about it. It was very, very quick. None of us really saw it coming.
And he's such a pivotal player, just the on-field stuff, a pivotal player for what you're hoping to achieve with the Kangaroos. But I imagine as a guy around the club and in the locker room and all that sort of stuff, he'd be a fairly important presence too to have around. I can't see him being the effervescent bouncing off walls type, but just that sort of calm dude that's always there, just going about his business, but he's always there, and he won't be for a little while now.
Yeah, I think his on-field presence is much bigger than his off-field presence in the change rooms, that's for sure. But, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, we wish the family and Ben all the best, and we're hoping that they're going okay. But, yeah, it is one of those things that where footy really takes a back seat, and, you know, from my perspective, I don't think any of us really care about what we're missing on the footy field. We just want Ben to be all good and be back with us as soon as possible.
Absolutely. I'm sure that is the case. And you've been around a while. You've been a few rodeos, so you've got a fair bit more balance and perspective, I imagine, than some of the younger players who are just trying to forge their careers and headstrong into everything. Are those moments sort of shocking for them? Are they sort of eye-openers for them as well, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's probably a good message for everyone to understand that, you know, that you do need to make sure you're getting all your health checks done, and any reminder we get of that is really important. So I think that side of things is really important. But I think, you know, we sat down as a group and we went through and in little groups about, you know, talking about what your first thoughts were and all that sort of stuff. So it was, you know, we handled the best we could psychologically, and I think it seemed like the group were handling it as well as you can. And obviously, there's a lot of information that we don't have yet that we've just got to wait for. So, you know, I think that's always hard. We've got that unknown, but, you know, the whole group seems to be handling it as well as we can.
How much time, just on that sort of stuff, how much time is dedicated in the program to chatting in groups about things that aren't necessarily football related, but just like relationship based conversations or issues in outside the game that you perhaps need to talk about? Is there an allocated time for that per week, or is that just as you need to do?
That sort of thing is not usually a formal setting. So, you know, you have care groups and you have different groups that look out for each other and have chats and check in and make sure your mate's doing all right. So we do that sort of more informal situation. You know, it might be grabbing a coffee, takeaway coffee these days together, or it might just be, you know, if you get 5 minutes on your own in the locker room just to have a chat, things like that. You probably do a bit more of. And I think that's definitely, you know, it, I think it's an understanding that, you know, a really close group that genuinely cares about each other has the best opportunity to do really well. And I think that's what we find at the footy club, is that we don't need to sort of manufacture that as much, because it happens organically a lot.
Chris Anstey is on the line. He's an Australian basketballing legend. He knows plenty about Olympic campaign 2000, 2008. He was there, missed the 04 one in Athens with injury, but knows what it takes to win medals. That's what he does, because he's a champ. And we're hoping the Boomers can do that again today against, well, not again, for the first time, against the US today in the semi-final. Looking forward to getting to the medal rounds. Chris, good morning.
Good morning. And, yeah, we woke up. It was one of those mornings you woke up and it's so exciting. It's nervous. It's just, I guess, cross your fingers when you've got no control and hope. It becomes one of those historical days for Australian basketball. And, you know what, it just, this group feels just a little bit different, and although it's the United States, we've proven we can beat them now. We've seen it in practice games. We haven't done it in a major event yet, but the sense of belief around the group is very high.
That does seem to be one of the keys, and I want to explore that a bit more with you shortly. Let's go back to yesterday, if we can, to finish off and sign off on the Opals campaign. It certainly didn't go to plan, even from the start, before they even started with the whole Liz Cambage situation, but they won one game through the tournament, the round-robin phase, and then were absolutely mauled by the US yesterday in their elimination game, the quarterfinal. The first 8 minutes, it was all over, Chris. What happened?
Yeah, you've described it perfectly. The preparation was disjointed. We, you know, not only did we lose Liz, we brought three girls who were carrying injuries into camp, and even in the lead up to such an important event, we could only put nine players on the court at times. So it's very, very difficult to prepare all of your systems, especially when they're based around a person who's not there, when you've only got nine players. So that put us behind the eight ball from the start. But they just didn't click. It was clunky. We didn't have the depth of talent. And we got shown out against China. The world's been chasing the United States for a long time, but we've been closest. And the world's caught up to us. So we've got to make sure we go home, we lick our wounds, we reset. They're a great group of girls. We've got some great young talent coming through. So I think we finished probably where we should have based on form, but I guess disappointing. The US too good, but we look to the men now.
Brad Johnson is our Thursday morning specialist around these parts. We love having him part of the team, and he's back again this morning. Good morning, Jono.
Good morning, Harf. Good morning, Whitey. Good to see you guys. How are you?
We're going very, very well. How's your world?
World's good. World's pretty good. Yeah, pretty cruisy, to be honest with you. It's nothing too exciting happening, Harf. Just waiting for the rounds to come out every Monday and Tuesday. I sit on the edge of my seat waiting to see where I'll be on the weekend, and then my week's set. I'm ready to go. So it's and it's good. It's good that we're still ticking along. I understand the complexities around it. We talk about it all the time, but ultimately we've got this round coming up, and there's some important games within this round for what potentially could be some final spots for some teams, some top four spots for some teams, and then others that are fighting for that position in the eight. Oh. And who knows? We could see the Blues. Out of the eight on percentage after this round. And who would have thought that when we've been assessing them and the ups and downs throughout this entire season?
Well, that whole 7-8 sort of thing is bizarre. How that's unfolded in the last 3 weeks in particular is just bizarre, Jono. And it highlights, I think, the challenges that everyone faces through this current climate of professional sport that we live in, that the uncertainties, you say, not knowing where you're going, and that can change midweek. You don't know how you're going to get there, what time that's going to happen. You've got no way to plan, and you're just going to go out there and do your business. And I think we're seeing the results on the back of that.
Yeah, no question whatsoever. It's the ups and downs. No one wants to. There's about six teams that don't want to play finals this year. I think we might as well finish with the top seven and off we go, because no one wants to grab that and really own it at the moment. And when you look at this week, like you look at Essendon, who's got a healthy percentage, but they play the Dogs. So you've generally got to, they could beat the Dogs with some of the way they play, but you've got to go to the teams that are, above them at the moment. So, you know, the Saints play the Swans, so that you think the Swans would win that one. Richmond play North, so Richmond should jump up with a victory there. The Blues play the Suns, so you'd think that they would take care of the Gold Coast Suns as well. But who knows with the Gold Coast Suns? They could come out and play extremely good footy for this week. And then you've got the Dockers and the Lions as well, which is at over in Perth, but the Lions, and they haven't been in great form also. So there's, as we said, there's some intriguing matchups that'll happen throughout this week. But the most intriguing matchup that I think will happen in the near future half is yourself versus Nick Del Santo. Now, I'm really looking forward to seeing what happens over the AFLW season. I know that through every training session you do, you'll have a little Nick Del Santo just sitting on the back of your head, in the back of your thought process, and just wondering, how am I going to take this newcomer into the coaching business?
I won't be letting him get the better of me, I'll tell you that much, Johnny. I don't want these Johnny come lately just strolling into town thinking they run the joint. This is my town.
There's only one game changer.
That's the attitude.
My town, Johnny.
Did it surprise you, Johnny? I mean, obviously you work with Nick at Fox, and he has gone back to St Kilda in recent years in a couple of different roles. But this one's caught a few people by surprise. What about you?
Oh, it didn't surprise me in terms of talking to Nick pretty much every week about coaching. We've been away, AFL Academy together. His thoughts on the game and the way that he can coach the game is excellent. It's top shelf sort of stuff.
That's a
good
sir.
Now it's about taking a whole group. That's the biggest challenge, I suppose, and leading a whole group forward in terms of where they want to go as a footy club. But I've got no question in around that. Yeah. The only thing is, we're pretty close, Nick and I, but he didn't say a word. He kept this one really quiet.
Is that right?
So that's a credit too. See, I like that. The fact that, and the Saints should understand now, they've got a guy that's, he doesn't talk outside the four walls. So so look out there. He did well. He hit it well, and he would have been tempting at times, I suppose, to maybe let someone know that, hey, this is what I'm doing at work, but didn't go there. So credit to him with that. He stayed in the process really tight.
So is he more Ross Lyon or more Malcolm Blight?
He can do the Ross Lyon walk really well. I know that. He'll be calm. He'll be calm and controlled. I think Nicky Dell, he'll do it with a smile on his face. He just loves it.
Yeah, it'll be interesting.
He can do what he likes and he walks away with 0 points.
I can't see Dell getting too angry too often either. It's very calm and measured.
He's serious though when it comes to his footy. That's one thing he is. So we know it can, and we say the same about half, but he can bubble over too every now and then. So, you know, he's got the girls. Half's hilarious. So I've only been into the Inner Sanctum once at the Blues, and it was a great introduction that the half gave me, and you could see that the girls are just like they're entrenched on every word that he is saying. So once you've got the group like that, and you can sense it as soon as you walk into a place, and I'm not just saying it because we're close half, but you can tell that as soon as you walk into a footy club environment, and if you've got that, then you can go either way. You have, you know, the light-hearted moments with your players, but you've got those serious moments as well where you sort of, as Rodney used to do, grab us on the forearm and pull you into the office to have a nice chat about where your footy's at and how you can get better.
All right. I asked this to the boys on Monday, and I'm going to ask you, of the sort of like a power rankings type situation. From 7 to 13, West Coast, Fremantle, the Giants, Essendon, Richmond, Carlton and St Kilda, there are two spots available. Who are the best two teams of those six? So there's two questions. Who are the best two teams of those six, but who are the two that you think will make it with three rounds to go?
Wow, that's West Coast, I think, are in that. So I
you're banking
consider
them?
West Coast. Yep, I think they can. Look, we've had the fluctuations. I know the next couple of weeks will tell us a lot with the West Coast Eagles, but ultimately the list that they've got, the games they'll play at home, I can't see them missing. I just can't.
They get a bit jumpy this week. If Melbourne beat them on Monday night, they get a bit jumpy, don't they?
Well, they've got Melbourne, they do, Brisbane and Freo.
Yeah, so I think they'll be okay. I think they could come down. Imagine that, the game versus Fremantle to secure a spot for either team in the finals. That could be one of the biggest derbies of all time.
Get Dale Kickett back.
That we might have to, and Michael Gardner, and we'll get Pav to run out from the boundary and just get involved in it again. So that could be enormous. That sort of game. Look, I lean towards Essendon. I really do. I think they're a side on the rise, and it's interesting talking to the Essendon fans around and the couple that I do know quite well. That they go either way. Some say, oh, I'd love to play finals. Some say, we don't want to play finals this year. And it's a really interesting mindset in terms of the way a couple of the fans are thinking, because if they play a final and they get blown out of the water, for example, that would be like, is that a waste of a year? Does that change the narrative on where we're seeing Essendon at the moment and the positive nature of the way they're building their list, the way Rutten is coaching? Are they, should it be, you know, that, and I don't think that. I think you should just strive to be where you need to be. Where you finish is where you finish, and you have a crack come of finals. If you get beaten, you know what you've got for the next year. But it's just an interesting narrative around some of the supporters at the moment and the way they're thinking about their team.
Well, I think they say that because every time Essendon plays a final in the last 15 years, they get belted.
and look, all those storylines come up, don't they? And it does sit with the fans. It certainly does. It sits with the media as well. So that's where, you know, it's a really interesting one. I'd love to see them make it. I really would. I think, you know, the way Ben Rutten has coached that side this year, a bit more freedom in the way that they're moving. You can see the pattern of play they like to produce. It's exciting too. They're a good team to visually watch, the Bombers. So, you know, I hope they're the probably two teams, the Eagles and the Bombers, to pinch those spots.
Who did you end up going with, Hunt?
I can't remember.
No, I can't either.
How am I supposed to remember that? It was Monday.
Because I think it's actually bordering on impossible. Because I'm still with Richmond. I can't give up on Richmond. Even though I probably
who's got shouldn't. The easiest run there, Whitey? Have you got the easiest run of the lot?
It's hard to it's hard to know what's easy and what's
yeah,
not.
That's right. That's the challenge.
So Richmond have got North Melbourne this week, then they've got the Giants,
and Hawthorn.
And then they've got Hawthorn.
Well,
so
there you go.
I reckon there's there's minimum two there for Richmond.
There is. You've got to get two out of three, and you've got to knock someone else in the process. So the Tigers can knock out the Giants, or the Giants will knock out the Tigers in this.
Yeah.
In this process.
Yes. So the problem is for Richmond is their percentage is 98 versus Essendon's 102. But that would get them to 40 points, Richmond, if you just give them two of three. Now, they could easily get three of three, but say it's two of three. Essendon, I think they can only get to 40. I can't see how they can beat the Bulldogs, but they should be able to beat Collingwood and Gold Coast. And then it's the Giants that are the wild card because they've got those 2 points. So the percentage isn't important to them. So if they get two wins, they get to 10.5. And they've got that game against Richmond. The Giants-Richmond
it's
could be the
now.
One. I reckon that's the one
that's
that
right.
decides it.
Because
the
totally
Giants
agree
also
with that.
Got
when you
Carlton and Geelong. They won't beat Geelong, but if they win their last two, they'll get to 10.5, which might put them out of Richmond and Essendon.
Yeah, it does. That's spot on in terms of that. That game next week, the Giants versus the Tigers, is enormous now in the context of the way you just explained that and the 2 points that they do have over their rivals that are in the same spot on the ladder. So that becomes absolutely enormous. I hope they put it on I don't know whether they can play the Friday night again, the Giants, but that'd be a ripper to start the round.
Yeah, I mean, the Giants are central to everything just because of who they play, because they've got Carlton this week. Carlton in round 23. They've got Richmond. And then this week, they have Geelong. So probably not so much this week, but those last two games, they're elimination finals. But they control their own destiny because they've got those 2 points.
That's right. And that's the benefit they've got. That's what you want to be at this stage. You want to be able to control your own destiny, not relying on others to be losing so that you can step up into the eight. I remember one year we sat at the Spotswood Bowls Club Essendon v Melbourne to see. I think we needed either or one or the other to win. I think it was the Bombers to beat the D's that year for us to play final. So we sat there for three quarters. It was close. And then halfway through the last, we're on the beers because Melbourne blew it open, I think it was. So it was a shocking day, you know, like they had radio stations out the front and we're all talking, you know, yeah, we're still in it, we're all that. And it was one of those days. So you don't want to be relying on that rather than having it in your own hands, which the Giants do.
This isn't meant to be a provocative question at all, but could it be possible that Fremantle are better without Nathan Fyfe? Nathan Fyfe is a wonderful player.
He's a two-time Brownlow medalist.
I know he is. He's one of the best players in the competition. But
history.
As a team, are they could they be better without him? Or is that stupid?
Oh.
I would never call you stupid. Yeah,
no, it's,
but I'm thinking about
I understand
it.
The question. I do understand the question on the basis of what their midfield produced last week, what they produced as a team,
which, playing as a team.
Yeah, which was great. Yeah. No doubt whatsoever. So, therefore, Do you think a couple of clubs have maybe just mentioned to Fife's management, look, we can provide a Hail Mary deal here for Fife?
Because that's what I was thinking. I was watching a news bulletin last night where he was interviewed, because obviously he's had his shoulder reconstruction and he's out for the season. And you just go, wow, could we get him a little bit cheaper off the back of a shoulder injury if we made a play for him? And just the way he sets up as a player, that it's kind of about him, not about the midfield group. But when he's not there, I don't know, do they gel a bit better? I mean, that was a big win to do that under pressure. And it was about Chera. It was about Brayshaw. It was about all the guys in that midfield that were all part of a collective group rather than relying on Nathan Fyfe to get them over the line.
Well, that's right. And Walter's not playing as well as Alex Pearce. So three keys out, everyone thought, nah, there's no chance. And they produced the effort that they do. Chera is the interesting one in this whole discussion. We've been talking about him for a while. We know that. So that's where the Fyfe scenario stays at Fremantle. I understand your thinking around it, though, Whitey. I really do, because of the type of midfield they have got in the future that, you know, they bring to the footy club. But, you know, you got to be careful too. We don't want to be pushing, you know, champions of your club for a long time out. I still see that as an important cog within your organisation. So I know Hawthorn have done it in their own way, but they'd won their premierships and won their flags, those players, and I can see the conversations in around that coming towards the end and where your group's at. But someone like a Fremantle, you know, this could, if they did that for an example, or he decided to leave, that could tear away too much of the fabric of the place.
I reckon that's a really good point, Jono. And I think in this modern world of free agency and player movement and this NBA-style go somewhere to win a flag thing, I reckon that's actually crippling a lot of clubs. Not crippling, but really destroying fabrics of clubs. And you talk about the champions, and you were one of those with the Bulldogs. And if you'd gone somewhere else, that would have taken a piece of the Bulldogs out. And Fife's the same from Fremantle. And I think we are very, very quick at the moment. If our team isn't winning a flag this year or next month, we're trying to find a way to get rid of one of our guns and get another kid in, get a good kid in that's going to be a good player for 10 years, rather than use those players as building blocks for the foundation of the future with culture and history and what it makes to be a part of a club. I reckon we're really quick to get rid of people. This is the whole Trent Cotchin conversation from about a month ago.
Trying to retire him off. I agree. I'm not talking about Fyfe in this situation. I'm just talking about the role that he plays for Freo. Mm. And at times it was a little bit like that with Essendon with James Hird, that it all was centralised around one player and everyone had to sort of support the one player to enable him to play the way he needs to play. Whereas when he's not there, they just seem to be a more collective group. And so it's not about whether Fyfe's a good player or not. It's just whether, I don't know, there's something about that group when he's not there.
But that's a coaching issue. If that's the way it was, perhaps, like for Justin Longmuir's come in recently, if that's the way it was, everyone had to play to help Fyfe, and that was the way we won games. Well, that's not going to last. That's not sustainable. Because Fyfe will get injured or he'll get sat on and all of a sudden you can't win a game of footy. So you've got to find a system that everyone plays. That we hear it all the time. Everyone plays their role, Jono. So if we're worrying about one player and focusing on them and working just for them, then you're never going to be a decent club or a decent team anyway. But if that player has had that level of responsibility and expectation but can come back underneath and be a part of the whole system, then you're a chance.
Well, it depends too. Like, you look at someone like Fyfe, and you can understand the conversations that may be happening internally because of, you know, the opposition targeting him every week. Who do the opposition want to stop in the midfield? It's Fyfe. You've got to restrict his impact. So therefore, as a teammate, half of your mindset at stoppage and bits and pieces is, okay, is Nathan all right here? Is he getting tagged? Do I need to go block for him first? Rather than what Whitey's talking about now when he's not there, you don't have that as a player. So your mindset is purely focused on, you know, where you're going in stoppage, where you can run freely from this stoppage and all that sort of stuff. And you can play a more natural game rather than trying to always in the back of your mind have your eye on your best player to support him, because that's probably the way it's been driven within probably from Fyfe in himself, because we used to do it. If you're getting sat on, you know, come and look after me, block for me at this stoppage, that sort of stuff. And that's where the younger players have probably just got that freedom when he's not there. And I think that's tends to be what Whitey's sort of alluding to here, is the more freedom in performance rather than still having elements of that, but it's not a total freedom because your best player's there and you're obviously trying to support him as well because he's the match winner.
It's like when Libra and Jose and Dimmer were trying to tag me.
You're asking for support, you take out the key player,
and you got no love. You know? You need that love, you need that support.
And you yelled out, I remember one day you yelled out to Crawf, come and block for me, and he just laughed at you.
He was still trying to work out who I was. Yeah. He didn't know my name. There's a couple of days to go on the Olympic campaign, and one of the highlights has absolutely been the performance of the track team. We know the swim girls and the boys did their thing, but the track staff has been just pulsating. And I wonder what it's been like for Nick Bedeau, one of the Australian athletics coaches who joins us on the line from Tokyo. Nick, thanks for your time.
Yeah, good morning. It's a lot of fun. Bit of work, it's good fun.
I'm sure there's a bit of work behind the scenes. We're only seeing the activity on the track, of course. What's your assessment so far? Is this what you expected from the team, or has it gone ahead of some of the predictions?
I think we've gone well. You always hope we do a little bit better because, you know, everyone takes us some medals, but I think the way that we've competed in general has been really good. I've seen a bit of a change in the positivity and the purpose in the way that athletes have approached the competition. So in general, I think things are looking up and we're representing ourselves a bit better and the people at home are enjoying it.
Well, we're having a hell of a time watching it. Don't worry about that. And we thank you for all the work that the team's put together to do it. But you talk about the energy in the team, the vibe of the team. Looking from afar, looking from on the couch, there does seem to be a really strong atmosphere and connection between this team. How do you get that for an individual athletes working within a team? How do you get that bond?
Well, it just sort of spreads. And I think if there's an expectation and everyone understands the expectation is that absolute best effort and commitment and, you know, taking it to the opposition and really putting your best out there, it just starts to spread. Everyone knows that that's the bare minimum. And, you know, the games only come around every so often and we've had to wait an extra year for this one. So people have really got their minds set on delivering a performance that represents all their family and friends and people have known them all their lives and supported them all their lives. You'll be watching them, which they don't always do watch them in our sports, to represent themselves well.
So you kind of touched on it, Nick, but are you not surprised with what you're seeing, or is this something that you go, well, gee, well, we knew that it was coming, but it's coming a bit quicker than we thought?
We've always discussed that we've got to have a bit better approach and people have got to understand what's required and how tough it is, how competitive it is. You can't afford to show any weakness here. You get opened up and you get exposed, so just a bit better understanding of that with every team member as they come on board. You know, normally, we're not really exposed to this sort of level of competition in Australia. They're only competing against other people in Australia, and normally you win if you're better than others. But here, everyone's at pretty much the same level, and you've got to have more than just ability to win. And I think they've just gradually been getting a bit of understanding of that.
It might be like asking you to choose which is your favourite child, but has there been a performance that you've been most proud of or most happy of actually seeing over the last week?
Look, there's been a lot. Like, you know, in the Australian team, Danny was great, and the discus stark was great, and the high jump, Brooke Stratton was fantastic. Bowl was fantastic in these three races. And then there's been a lot of people who haven't done quite as well who've been really well. Jen, you know, rupture Achilles last night was brave in getting to the final and getting to the last water jump before she booked herself about a 7 month holiday with her Achilles rupture. There's been a lot of them. You don't just like one. It's just the whole attitude. It's good to see amongst our team, and I think we're going to see it for the rest of the week.
We've got some action today too. Love to get your take on that. Ollie Hoare and Stu McSwain in the 1500 metres. We saw Jess Hull and Lyndon Hall do their job last night to make the final. What do we expect from the boys today?
Well, I think they'll run with purpose and be aggressive. And I think they can both make the final if they execute properly and do the job. I've got no doubt they're both good enough. They've just got to make no mistake and stick to their plans, and they should be in the final. The girls last night were great. They did exactly that. They ran with purpose, stuck to the plans they had, and first time ever we got two women in the Olympic 1500 metres final, and I think they'll both be in the front half of the field in the top eight.
Yeah, well, they ran beautifully last night, and the commentary was very excited about it, as were we on the couch. Is there a medal coming our way on the track anytime soon?
Well, we've got Maloney and the Decathlons in second place at the moment. I'm just checking it out, watching him start 110 metre hurdles this morning. He's probably in the best position. Let's see if these two boys get in the final. If these, if we finally walk and get in the final, they're certainly in contention. They've both shown in the Diamond League circuit they can place in the top three. So if they've got to get the final first. If they do, I would say they're a chance.
And the Peter Bowl situation last night, we were talking about it before, and obviously, well, everyone's been talking about it for the last couple of days. Had he had a bit more pace on and someone to perhaps be a bunny for him, could have been a different outcome, do you reckon?
Yeah, possibly, but that's the way it is in Olympic racing. You can't organise a pacemaker beforehand, and he probably had a decision to make once they got 200 or 300 in. If it went too slow, he probably wasn't any chance to win.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.